Hi, good morning, everybody. This is about 2:41. It is September 18th. We're going to have our second lecture on Chapter 3, Cell Structure. So let's take a look at the schedule. And how many more lectures do we have before your lecture exam? Just today, and that's it. So if you got some questions, now is a really good time. Okay, but before we get started, do we have any announcements from SI? Announcements from SI?
There will be an SI session next Tuesday, right before the exam, from 9:15 to 11. Thursday session will be canceled because there will be no material to cover. But my email did change, so please refer to the board. If you need to contact me, please contact me via the email that's new. If you email me the old one, I will still get it, but I won't have access to it in the near future.
Okay, thank you. Hopefully the information in Blackboard is current.
Right.
I think it is, right? We worked on that. Yeah, we worked on that last time. Okay. All right, so looking at the schedule. Next meeting will be Tuesday, and that's going to be your first exam. Chapters 1, 2, 3, and 6. And what do you need for that exam when you walk in the door? What should you have with you? A pencil. I heard pencil. A good eraser. Make sure it works with your pencil. Double check. You have to do an experiment before the exam. Make sure it works. What else? Pencil, eraser. A calculator. Yes. What kind of calculator? One that does not have a phone in it, right? One that can't store a lot of information. We call that a basic scientific non-graphing calculator. Just as it's stipulated in the syllabus. All right, so all these things are in the syllabus. So let me see. Oh yeah, what else? So you need a calculator, you need a Scantron 882E. Or you can get an 882ES, that's fine with me, but not the 882 Lovas. That messes things up because the letters are grayed in or greened in or something. And I think your Scantron is a green color. Is that right? Does it look green to anybody? Okay, it's not determined at this point, but it should look green. I would tell you, but I never know what color things are. So that's what you need. Oh, I also forgot one last thing. A picture ID is necessary. A picture ID. If you do not have a picture ID, maybe this afternoon go over to administration, and I think they cost $1.50. You can get it the very same day. So get a picture ID. If you do not have a picture ID on Tuesday, I still want you to take the test. You're still required to take the test on time, but I just can't tell you what your grade is until I get an ID from you, picture ID. All right, so that's a hassle. It's a hassle for everybody if you do not bring a picture ID on Tuesday. Okay, so that's it for schedule and the things that you need next time. Okay. Oh, and the other thing is you can't share pencils during the test. You can't share erasers during the test. You can't share calculators during the test. You can't share Scantrons during the test, right? So make sure that you have all your own stuff. I know a lot of people like to share things during the test, but you cannot do that. All right. No questions. Good. Well, let's move on to what we were talking about. And we were talking about the central dogma in biology. This is just a review of what we were doing. Oh, this is what I wanted to do. I wanted to do this right here. Okay. Oh, here. And then here. Here and here. Okay. All right, so what's another title we could put on this page? It's that title, but we could put another title that would be just as descriptive. And protein synthesis. Yeah, so here we're looking at protein synthesis. And on the slide, we see that protein synthesis requires how many major steps? Two. You got two arrows. And do these arrows go in opposite directions or both directions or only one direction? Only one direction, right? So information in DNA gets converted into information in RNA, and then that information in RNA gets converted into information in a protein. So what's the language of DNA? What is the basic building block of DNA? It's a nucleotide. What's the basic building block in RNA? A nucleotide, right? So what's the language of DNA and RNA? It's the same, right? So RNA is just a copy of DNA. And what do we say, what do we call that when we make a copy of something?
Transcription,
right? So this first arrow is transcription. All right, but now, the second step right here, what's the language of protein? What's the building block of a protein?
Amino acid.
Amino acid. That's different than RNA, correct? Yeah, but the information should be the same, shouldn't change. So what do you call that, going from one language to another without changing any of the information value? That's translation, right? All right, what are some other things? Where is DNA always found? In the nucleus. So where does transcription always take place? In the nucleus, because the DNA never leaves the nucleus. And what about translation? In the cytoplasm. That happens in the cytoplasm. And then you should know, what's the workbench for making a protein? That is the ribosome. What are some other things we looked at? Oh, we talked about genes. We say that proteins come from genes, and that our body actually produces more proteins than we have genes. And how can we possibly explain that? How can we explain that our body can make more proteins than we have genes? We invoke alternate splicing of these exons together. Right, so here we see that picture where there are three exons, and this is all controlled on one gene. And so if it's spliced, if these three exons are spliced together, that will produce a certain kind of protein. Right? If just the end exons are spliced together, that will create a second protein. Or if the first one and the middle one are spliced together, that will produce a third kind of protein. So more than one protein can be made by one gene. And that is why the proteome is greater than the genome. So hopefully that makes sense when I said that. All right. So alternate splicing is what we use to explain how we make so many different kinds of proteins in our body. All right. Well, what we see right here is these round structures, and probably you would be able to tell me what these spherical structures are. These are the ribosomes, and that's the workbench for making a protein. I also see a really long linear molecule going right through all of those ribosomes. That is messenger RNA. That is the dictionary on how to spell out a particular protein. And remember, the building block of a protein are those amino acids. And so there has to be instructions to put these amino acids together in just the right order in order to get the right kind of protein. Because if it changes, then the structure of that protein is going to change, and then, of course, you know, the function is going to change. So you can think of that messenger RNA as being the dictionary and how to spell a word properly. If you change the letters in a word, what happens to that word? Is it the same word? It changes. It's not the same word. Same thing. If you change that sequence of amino acids put into a protein, you change the protein. So we see the messenger RNA is very long. It can accommodate more than one ribosome at a time. I never counted it out, but we could count maybe, 20 ribosomes on this one messenger RNA. So there are 20 of the same proteins being made by this structure here that we call a polysome. And here I can see that there here is the protein, this thing, and then over here, look at how long the protein is. Right, so where is closer to the beginning of translation on this slide? Is it going to be on the left or is it going to be on the right? It's going to be on the left because this protein is shorter, right? And as the polysome adds amino acids, it gets longer and longer and longer and longer. And so over here, these ribosomes are getting very close to the stop signal. And at that particular time, then this polypeptide will be released into the cytoplasm or into the endoplasmic reticulum, depending on where this ribosome is located. Okay, so that's protein synthesis. So if you're going to pick one of two processes, right, you told me there are two main processes for protein synthesis, which one is this that we're looking at? Which one is taking place on a polysome? Okay, so my question is, a little bit more specifically, is it transcription or translation happening here? Okay, it is translation, right? Going from the RNA molecule to information in a protein, that's translation. And then the other thing that we saw routinely were ribosomes in the cytoplasm. And so you also know that translation takes place in the cytoplasm, not inside the nucleus. Okay, so you might be wondering, how is it that that this protein can be made according to the instructions in this messenger RNA? Because messenger RNA is nucleotides, and proteins are made out of amino acids. There's got to be some kind of decoder ring or some kind of dictionary that tells you, right, that if you have a certain arrangement of nucleotides in RNA, you're going to have a certain arrangement of amino acids in a protein. And sometimes we call that decoding when it goes through that step. And here is the what we call the genetic code. As a matter of fact, I would like for you to write down universal genetic code. This tells us how the sequence of nucleotides in a nucleic acid determines the sequence of amino acids in a protein. Maybe a better way of saying that is this universal genetic code tells us what the order of nucleotides are in RNA and how that corresponds to the order of amino acids in a protein. So how the order of or the sequence, you could use either one of those. Well, how many different nucleotides do you know exist for RNA? How many are there? How many nucleotides are there? And you should know their names too. There are four. I heard four. What are their names?
Adenine.
Uracil. Ah, good. Because uracil is an RNA, not DNA. And then?
Guanine
and cytosine. All right, so you got four nucleotides. But how many amino acids are there? Are there four? There are at least 20 common ones. Right, so you can't just pick one nucleotide to determine one particular amino acid because you would need 20 different nucleotides, different ones, to select out for 20 different amino acids, right? But there are only four. So how is it possible that only four nucleotides can specify one of each of these 20 amino acids? Well, it's because not one nucleotide specifies. Right? And two still won't be enough. There has to be three nucleotides together that will correspond to one particular amino acid. And that's what we see on this chart. So if there is a UAG in a messenger RNA, that's going to signal to stop translation to take place. If there is UUU, right, that's going to specify that a phenylalanine, that's a kind of amino acid, that is put into the growing protein at that location. All right, so what about AAA? AAA, what's happening there? What kind of amino acid is going to be put into that growing polypeptide chain at that location where you have AAA? It says right here, it's going to be a lysine. So these are all different kinds of amino acids. I don't want you to be able to tell me which one is which, all right, but I think you have to know what the general structure of an amino acid is. Amino acid has what kind of groups on it? It's got an amino group, it's got a carboxyl group because that's the acidic group, and then these different amino acids are different in that location that has that R associated with it. Like cysteine has a sulfhydryl group, for instance. All right, so what has to be the sequence of nucleotides in RNA to put a cysteine into that growing protein? It has to be UGU. So it's the job of the ribosome to uncover this particular segment of the messenger RNA and then put in that cysteine amino acid right at that particular location. So we say this is the universal genetic code because all organisms use basically the same genetic code. Doesn't matter if you're a fungus, a bacteria, okay, a mammal, bird, reptile, or whatever. It's the same genetic code. Maybe a couple little modifications here, but basically it's the same genetic code, so we say it's universal. So this might be the most amazing slide that you'll look at the whole semester, right? Because the code is the same for all organisms. And so that gives some credence to what kind of theory? The theory of, since all organisms are the same at this molecular level, right, that is some evidence for evolution, right? So that is, it doesn't prove evolution, right? But at least it does not refute evolution, and it actually supports evolution, the theory of evolution. Okay, so where do we have these things that determine the amino acid? It's going to be on messenger RNA, not any other kind of RNA. And so we have codons on messenger RNA. So you might want to just draw in like a little M right here. We have codons on messenger RNA. And also don't forget, put down universal genetic code. I might ask you to translate a segment of RNA, but I would give you this universal genetic code in order to do that. Okay, so let's work maybe a couple examples. All right. The other thing that you should be able to tell me is if you have a sequence of GGG on DNA, right, how does that correspond to a sequence on a messenger RNA? What's going to be on a messenger RNA at this location? It's going to be CCC. The other thing you should tell me is that there should be like an arrow going here, right? Is this a one-way arrow or two-way arrow? One-way arrow. And what would you like, how would you like to label that arrow? You call that? Yeah, so it's going from left to right. I like that. But what's the name for that arrow? Yes, that's transcription, right? That's transcription. Okay. And how do you know that this C is always going to match up with a G? And it's a rule, and we call it base pair rule, is a way that you can explain that very quickly and concisely. Right? So base pair rules determine how these nucleotides, via that process of transcription, right, get put together. Okay, and remember that the enzyme that does that is RNA polymerase. So these triplets right here are all connected together in one big long polymer, which is what we saw right here. There's one big long strand of messenger RNA that's a polymer of nucleic acids that we see right here. Okay, so here we see some nucleic acids. We see some bases. I see some amino acids put together, so that probably means there's a protein someplace. All right, so this right here, what is this that we're looking at on the very top row?
DNA.
How do you know this is DNA? It's double-stranded. That's one reason. Another reason is you have thymine. You have T's in here, right? And so you only have thymine in DNA, and it's double-stranded. All right. But now let's try to make a protein out of this DNA molecule. What do you have to do first? You have to, yeah, you're right, but you have to unzip it, right? You have to separate the two strands so that what process can take place? Transcription, right? So here we have the DNA molecule now unzipped. I only see one strand of the DNA molecule. And then down over here, right, I see AUG. Can this be DNA? CUC. AUC. That's got to be RNA because there's no longer any thymines, right? So thymine has been substituted for uracil. So here we see a hybrid molecule, part DNA and then part RNA on the bottom. Right, so the DNA molecule is used as a template to make this RNA strand, and you know that process to be transcription. All right, so now we got this messenger RNA. Let's forget about the DNA molecule that was used to build it. Right, so here's messenger RNA. What do we call these first three nucleotides? That is a codon, right? And if we look at AUG on that universal genetic code, you're going to see that it doesn't code for a protein, it codes for, that's the start signal, right? So here is where you start the process of putting amino acids together, and as a matter of fact, what do we call that process of putting amino acids together based on information that we have in RNA? Yeah, that's translation, right? Does it say right here? Oh, it even says on the slide. Okay, well this is I hope this is a good exam figure. So this is a really good exam figure because it shows transcription, shows translation, demonstrates the use of the genetic code. Okay, and you could look at your universal genetic code and tell me that if you have a codon of GGC, what is that going to, how does that translate into an amino acid? What amino acid is going to be put at this second position within the protein, the second position, because here is the second codon. It's going to be glycine. You see glycine? Let's look. GGC. Where's GGC? Do we have, I picked one that's not on this list. Is there one? Oh, yeah, GGC. All right. GGC stands for glycine, and is that what we have right here? Indeed it is. Okay, so you need three nucleotides, which we call a codon, on messenger RNA to determine which one of 20 different kinds of amino acids are put into this position right here. And then, the ribosome, this is going to go through a ribosome eventually. The ribosome is going to move over to this position, and then it's going to see UCC on the messenger RNA. What is UCC considered? That is a codon that codes for serine. All right? And then the ribosome is going to move down three more nucleotides on that messenger RNA, and it's going to see AUC. Right, that's what we call a codon, right? A sequence of three nucleotides. That's the fourth codon. Look at that universal genetic code, and we see that isoleucine, that's the name of an amino acid, is going to put into that fourth position. Right? It's not the fourth nucleic acid, because remember, these nucleotides are grouped in a series of three, so a codon contains three nucleotides put together. Okay, so this is a pretty good slide. Who's got a question on this slide? Anybody got a question on this slide? How would you explain that this uracil, okay, is going to bind to this adenine? Uracil on this RNA molecule is going to bind to this adenine in the DNA molecule. That is just what we call base pair rules. Base pair rules, okay? Just nice and simple like that, base pair rules. And in DNA, adenine is not going to bind uracil, it's going to bind thymine. How would we explain that? Base pair rules, right? Just nice and simple, base pair rules. Okay. All right, so we see that we have a messenger RNA is a really long molecule of RNA. It's a nice analog of DNA. There's another kind of RNA molecule, and we call that a tRNA. So here is a tRNA molecule. Kind of looks like a clover leaf. It's got these four arms sticking out of it. In some regions, it's double-stranded. It folds back on itself to give it this overall structure. And then on one end, there's an open end, and it has a special sequence AACC on it. That's probably not so important, but it's the designation that at this end right here, an amino acid is going to be attached. All right, so I tell you what kind of reaction is going to be used to attach an amino acid to this transfer RNA? A dehydration reaction, right? Just same thing over and over again. So now we have the transfer RNA with an amino acid, and it's going to wander around the cell and bring that amino acid to a ribosome so that that amino acid could be used to make a protein. So that's why we call this a taxi, or more appropriately, a transfer RNA. Its job is just to bring amino acids over to a ribosome. All right, so you got messenger RNA, which is like the dictionary for spelling out a protein. You got the transfer RNA that brings amino acids over for translation. Now, where does that all take place? In the cytoplasm. I like that. On what kind of organelle? A ribosome. And guess what? You need another kind of RNA to make a ribosome. Can't use DNA to make a ribosome, right? You're going to use RNA to make a ribosome. And what kind of RNA is that? Ribosomal RNA to make a ribosome. You also need a couple little proteins, but I think what you should just realize is that it needs RNA to make a ribosome. All right, so that's what we have right here. I see all different kinds of RNA on this picture. I see the long string of RNA that has codons right here. So what kind of RNA has codons? I see the first one here, the second one here, third one here. Right. So since it has codons, we know this is the messenger RNA. It's going to correspond to the order of amino acids that are used to make a protein. And it runs through a little tunnel of this structure here. And it looks like a little dot or sphere on all the micrographs that we're looking at. Here is the ribosome. Ribosome is made out of ribosomal RNA. And I see that here are two subunits of ribosomal RNA. They come together so that the messenger RNA actually goes right through a tunnel in that molecule, right through a tunnel in the ribosomal RNA. All right, and what's the third kind of RNA? that transfer RNA. So here I see a transfer RNA, and this number 6 right here represents a particular amino acid, one of the 20 different kinds, right? And so this is just diffusing around inside the cell. And now this transfer RNA is going to bind. Oh, look, 1, 2, 3. What does that remind you of? I see 3 nucleotides on this transfer RNA. What does that remind you of? Yeah, it reminds you of a codon. And we find codons on messenger RNA. And so these things we can't call a codon. We're going to call this an anticodon. All right? And so this transfer RNA will know to bind to a codon, okay, only one specific kind of codon it can bind to. And it will bind to it according to what kind of rule? The base pair rules. All right? So if this is an A, if this first nucleotide on a transfer RNA is an A, what has to be the first nucleotide on that codon? It's got to be a U. And if the second one is a C, the second one in the messenger RNA has to be a G. And if the third one is a U, what does the third one on the messenger RNA have to be? It has to be an A. So those are just base pair rules. So this transfer RNA will only fit into that codon if it has the right sequence of bases, right? And that's going to be according to the base pair rules that we all know about, which is in DNA, GCAT. In RNA, it's GCAU, right? And so when we look at this right here, are any of these strands, right, or any of these associations right here DNA? No, because there's no thymine, and indeed you see uracil, so it cannot be a DNA. So here is a zoomed-in region of this messenger RNA, and I see 2 codons, right, AUC, another codon is CCU, and now I can see the transfer RNA, right, according to the base pair rules, bringing in a particular amino acid. All right, so let's look at what else is happening right here. So it looks like codon number 1, number 2, number 3 have already gone through the ribosome. So these amino acids have been joined together. So if I look at the growing polypeptide chain, I would expect to see 3 amino acids and then something else happening inside the ribosome. Do I see 3 amino acids joined together? 1, 2, 3. The first one from this codon, which is called A, the second one from the B codon, 3 from the C codon. You could have just as well called this 1, 2, and 3, but maybe that would have been confusing because we're calling 1, 2, and 3 amino acids. Okay, so here is a transfer RNA matched up to the messenger RNA, and how do you know that these, what would you use to explain the binding of these nucleotides together? Just base pair rules, right? So there's only one kind of transfer RNA that's going to fit exactly based on base pair rules, right? And then here is the second position within the ribosome, and a free transfer RNA is going to bind to this region right here according to what? Base pair rules, right? And it's going to bring in an amino acid, and when it does, then a nice peptide bond is going to form between number 4 and number 5. And what kind of reaction is that going to be? Dehydration synthesis reaction, right? And after that is bound like that, okay, then this first transfer RNA releases amino acid number 4, and the protein then now is attached to this top transfer RNA by amino acid number 5, and that's what we see over here. So what's going to happen? Well, then the ribosome is going to move down to the next position, revealing the next sequence of 3 nucleotides, and what are we going to call that? That is the codon on a messenger RNA. And so it's available to bind a transfer RNA, and how would you explain the binding of transfer RNA to this codon right here? It's according to base pair rules, right? And you know what the nucleotides are. So then this one's going to come in here. Dehydration synthesis is going to take place on amino acid number 6. This transfer RNA is going to let go of amino acid number 5. Right, so that everything is going to be connected to amino acid number 6, and the ribosome moves down to the next codon, and this process just goes on and on and on and on and on, right? And you're going to end up with a lot of amino acids all joined together by peptide bonds, but it can't go on forever because what's going to happen? it's going to run into a stop sign. It's going to run into a UAG signal, and that's going to be a signal to stop that translation process and then cut away this growing polypeptide, and that will be the final protein, the final sequence of how this protein is made. Okay, so what are some of the key things? What do we have on messenger RNA? We have codons. What do we have in transfer RNA? Anticodons. How does a transfer RNA know to bind to a messenger RNA only at a specific location? Because of base pair rules that you're familiar with, right? And that happens, right, on this ribosome. And that's why we call the ribosome the workbench for protein synthesis, or the workbench for, probably even more specifically, definitely more specifically, for translation. The ribosome is the workbench for translation. And what does that mean? Going from the nucleotide language to the amino acid language. And that happens according to the, what is this, what did you write down on your slide? According to the universal genetic code. Okay. All right, so that's a lot of molecular biology. Maybe a little bit fast, but I think I'm recording this. Who's got a question? Maybe, hopefully you've studied this maybe a little bit before class or in another class to where you're uncertain about something and maybe you could ask me a question, right? Maybe this is so new you don't even know enough to ask me a question yet. I'm not sure where you are sitting, okay? So I don't see any hands. So I don't, oh, I do see a hand. Yes?
So does it
always end at 5? No. Okay, so this ribosome is going to march down this messenger RNA molecule, and there could be hundreds and hundreds of codons on that messenger RNA molecule. And this ribosome is going to keep marching down, and every time it marches one step, it's going to add an amino acid. Right, so if there are 1,000 codons on this messenger RNA, then there are going to be 1,000 amino acids put onto this one protein. Okay, and it will just keep going, and how will it know to stop? Because eventually there's going to be a codon with a AUG on it, and then the process is going to stop, and all those amino acids that are joined together are going to be cut away from this last transfer RNA, and that protein then will be floating around wherever it was made, which could be where? In the cytoplasm or cytosol, or it could be inside the rough endoplasmic reticulum, one of those two places, right? So, yeah, so proteins have more than 6 amino acids. Probably there are some useful polypeptides that have 8 amino acids, but I don't know any that are really short, like 6. But 8 is really close, right? There are some hormones that are just a few amino acids long. Okay, another question.
I was just going to ask where the proteins come out from.
Okay, so they're attached, right? So this protein is attached kind of to this messenger RNA, right? Because the transfer RNA is the connection between this growing polypeptide chain and the messenger RNA. When it reaches that stop sign, then this bond here is cut, and there's not another amino acid that's joined right here, and then that amino acid is free to float around in that environment that it's in. Okay, so it's cut right here. And when it reaches the stop sign, what happens? The ribosome splits apart. It then is released from the messenger RNA, and then the ribosome behind it can come up to that position and read the stop sign. And the ribosome behind it then splits apart, right, and releases its particular protein. So hopefully you can relate this ribosome surrounding the messenger RNA molecule and this elongating protein to this particular picture right here. Here's a ribosome, the messenger RNA is going through it, right, and here is a very short protein. The ribosome moves down over here, and when it does, this protein gets a little bit bigger because transfer RNAs bring in more amino acids, right? And then by the time it moves down all the way over here, the protein is really long. And maybe this will go on for 1,000 times or maybe 100 times, but it's going to stop whenever you have, an AUG signal in that messenger RNA. And then this protein is going to be cut away from that last transfer RNA, and float around wherever it was built. Right, so remember, there are two locations for these ribosomes. Can anybody remember where these two locations for these ribosomes are? Okay. Okay, let's see how fast I can get back here without getting sick. Okay. I see ribosomes. We call these free ribosomes in the cytosol. There are also ribosomes attached to rough endoplasmic reticulum. Right. All these ribosomes are involved in translation, producing a protein. The ones that are produced by a free ribosome, the proteins made by a free ribosome, are in the cytosol, floating around in the cytosol. The proteins that are made by rough endoplasmic reticulum are now contained within this membrane system, end up in a vesicle, which moves to Golgi apparatus, and there that protein can be modified and packaged in another vesicle. That vesicle can stay inside the cell, or it can move over to the cell membrane and exocytosed into the extracellular environment. So there are two possible fates for a protein. If it's by free ribosome, it's in the cytosol. If it's made by rough endoplasmic reticulum, it can end up outside the cell or inside of a vesicle, right? But not in the cytosol. So, yeah. Okay, it could be a protein hormone, so it could be a hormone, and so this cell then secretes that hormone, it diffuses to the blood, and then the blood carries it all over your body, and it's a signal to change the physiology of a cell someplace. Okay, and so in order for this protein that's being secreted to signal cells in some distant location of your body, because blood has taken it there, what does that other cell have to have in order to recognize, right, that protein, that the blood delivered to it? It's got to have a receptor to it. It's got to have a receptor, right? If that cell really far away has a receptor, then we call it a target cell or target tissue. But it has to have a receptor based on the complement. It has to have a complementary shape compared to the protein that this cell right here made. And then it can be a signal molecule on a cell that's far away. And if it is a hormone, the way it gets there is by the circulatory system. It goes through the blood system somehow. Because it's made by, a hormone is made by an endocrine gland. And remember, an endocrine gland does not have a duct. That's the basic definition of an endocrine gland. What's the name of a gland that has a duct? Can't be an endocrine gland. It's an exocrine gland. Exocrine gland, yeah. Okay. All right, so I know you got to deal with all these little concepts. Put them together, piece them together, and it's all this is really important stuff. So here is, on this very next slide, I tell you what, another question, did I skip anybody's question right here?
Is there a possibility that the codon will be in a mistake, and what happens if there's a mistake?
Yeah, if there's a mistake, right? Then the protein won't be made according to the right spelling. It won't have the right shape, so it won't have the proper function. Right. And if there's just one mistake like that, it probably won't affect the cell very much. But if it happens over and over and over again, for instance, if we go back over here, and all of these proteins that are being made have the wrong shape because the wrong amino acid was put in there, then that certainly is very harmful to the cell or to the whole organism. Now, how could that change? Well, we know that to put an amino acid into a growing protein, there has to be a codon, right, like UCC. But if there is some change in the DNA, we call that a mutation. For instance, if this C right here changed to an A, which means then that there would be a T over here, then that would call for a different kind of amino acid being put into the protein. So there can be a point mutation where just one base pair changes. And that sometimes is enough to cause a massive change, a drastic change in, sorry, what happened to it? A drastic change to the shape of this protein that's made. Okay. And that's enough to cause major changes in physiology of the individual, right? So that's what we call a mutation when there is, one way is by having a, sorry, point mutation, right, within the DNA molecule. It changes the codon, changes what amino acid gets put into that protein as it's built. And a classical example of that is when hemoglobin is made. Some people have a point mutation in their DNA, so they inherit this from their parents. And there's a difference in one amino acid in this protein, and when somebody is experiencing low oxygen, then that hemoglobin in their body doesn't make that nice four-unit molecule. It has a certain shape, and it changes that nice round red blood cell into something that looks like a sickle. It has pointy ends, and something that has pointy ends gets stuck everywhere in your body, capillaries. And so we call that sickle cell anemia, right? So just one little mutation causes that protein to misbehave like that, that changes the whole structure of the cell. And now these cells that have these little pointy points to them can't flow through a blood vessel very nice. They form thrombi. They plug up blood vessels instead of flowing through them. Yeah, so even a really simple mutation like that can be really drastic to the individual. So why do we have it? I mean, why hasn't it like just disappeared because of evolutionary processes? Yeah, how come it's not selected against? It just so happens that that change in the DNA helps individuals fight malaria. Okay? But there's a trade-off for that, right? It does produce sickle cell anemia. Yeah, yeah. I think the same for thalassemia. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so usually you have to think, well, what would be the benefit to that individual? Okay. There are other kinds of mutations that exist in our population that are not helpful, but they're still with us. Okay, because evolution has not had enough time. And what can you tell me about evolution in people through the human race? It's not just random, right? Because people select who their partners are going to be. So it's under the control of, we call that not natural selection, we call that artificial selection. Okay. So artificial selection can make like different breeds of dogs. That doesn't happen by itself. Right. So if it's guided by human thought, then we call that artificial selection. Right. Okay. All right. So here's the next slide. Any other questions? We're still talking protein synthesis. Here's a protein that's being made. All right, so what are we looking at here, transcription or translation? Translation, yeah, translation, because here's that nice messenger RNA molecule that has codons on it, right? And here we have a nice ribosome made out of ribosomal RNA. You can see the messenger RNA going right through it. And this ribosome is now associated with a pore in this membrane system. And so I want you to recognize this as being rough endoplasmic reticulum. And this protein, as it's made, right, has a special leader sequence on it. There are 30 amino acids, or about 30 amino acids, that are hydrophobic. And so they're able to go through the membrane and end up inside the cisternae, or the inside part of this endoplasmic reticulum. So now this protein is inside endoplasmic reticulum and can't float around in the cytosol anymore. So this protein is either going to end up outside the cell or in a vesicle someplace inside the cell, but not floating around in the cytosol. After this protein is made, then that leader sequence is broken off. Ah, what kind of chemical reaction would be used to remove that leader sequence? I think I heard hydrolysis. Indeed, right? So a hydrolysis reaction would be used to separate this leader sequence, and then you get the protein that you wanted. Okay, I think we got a couple more slides, not too much. Right, functions of the Golgi, what did we say? Give me two words that are two different concepts for the Golgi. What does Golgi do? Modifies and packages. So what does it modify? It modifies those proteins that are made by rough endoplasmic reticulum. So it will take the protein and maybe add a sugar molecule to it. And that will then make a glycoprotein, or sometimes we call it a mucopolysaccharide. And mucus, for instance, is a glycoprotein. It's a protein that has sugar on it. And you know some of the properties of mucus. Okay, so that's the modifying part. And then maybe that mucopolysaccharide or glycoprotein is put into a vesicle, and that vesicle leaves the Golgi. If it stays inside the cell, sometimes That protein, if it has lysozyme, becomes a lysosome. But for instance, if it is a hormone, it is exocytose. That vesicle moves over to the plasma membrane, and whatever inside that vesicle then is in the extracellular space around the cell. Okay, we call that exocytosis. So modification and packaging. Okay, when cells divide by mitosis, okay, mitosis starts with a, let's see if I can find something, cell cycle. Nice. All right. So when mitosis happens, you start with one cell that we have right here. This cell has got a general name. It's just a single cell. Okay, do you have slides for this? I think you do. Maybe you don't have slides for mitosis. This is just a single cell. And the process of mitosis is to take this cell and separate the genetic material into these two cells right here. And we're going to call these daughter cells. The cell that we started with is what we call a parent cell. So here's the parent cell. It's going to produce two daughter cells. And that process is called mitosis if one thing happens. Right? It's mitosis if, what can you tell me about these two cells right here, these two daughter cells? Okay, it divides into two. Okay, but there's something special about these two daughter cells. They have to be the same, right? So they're identical. Right? So mitosis produces identical daughter cells, but something else. If the daughter cells are the same, how do they compare to the parent cell? They are the same as well, right? So the process of mitosis, a parent cell divides into two daughter cells, and all of those cells are the same. Right, so the daughter cells are exactly the same as the parent cell. So, in a normal human cell, we have 46 chromosomes. So there are 46 chromosomes in this cell, but when it divides by mitosis, right, what can you tell me about the number of chromosomes in each of these daughter cells? Okay, what did we say? What's the difference between a parent and a daughter cell? They're the same. So if we started with 46 chromosomes, we have to end up with 46 chromosomes. But if now we take those 46 chromosomes and put them in two different locations, what does that mean? We got to take a chromosome and make another copy of it, right? So that when we split into two daughter cells, both of those cells have the same number of chromosomes. So that process is what we call replication. DNA replication. Rats, I don't have anything to drink. Anybody have a cough drop? No, because nobody has a cough. Okay. Rats, when are we done in here? Now? Right now? No. Okay, let me tell you a couple things about replication. Okay, so you know a DNA molecule, right? Is it double or single-stranded? It's double, right? And to make another copy of DNA, then you need two double-stranded molecules, right, to make another copy of it. So how does that happen? Well, the original DNA molecule is going to act like a template. Oh, thank you. It's going to act like a template. I should have thrown it at me. Thank you. Good, no, I got it. All right, so the original DNA molecule is going to act like a template to make some more DNA. So the information is on the inside of the molecule. So we have to unzip the molecule to get at that information. And that unzipperase is called a helicase. All right, so it unzips the molecule. Now, is it hard to unzip this DNA molecule? What's holding it together? Just hydrogen bonds, right? So it's relatively easy. You don't need ATP to do that. All right, so it unzips, and here is an original strand of DNA, and I see a C right here. So what nucleotide can bind to this cytosine? Only guanosine, right? So this strand of DNA is going to act like a template to build another strand over here. So every chromosome that's made this way has one complete original strand of DNA and one new strand of DNA. What about this one over here? One complete old strand and then one new strand. So both of these chromosomes have one old and one new strand of DNA. And that's what we call semi-conservative replication. The new chromosome is not made up of two old strands and two new strands. Not two new strands, okay, but one strand that's old, one strand that's new. And how is the old strand used? It's used as a template to make that new strand of DNA. All right, so if you want to make 100 copies of a certain kind of pair of pants or dress or shirt or something, and you want to make all those clothes exactly the same, what would you use to make 100 different pairs of pants the same? A template, right? So you'd cut out the material exactly the same way. So the original strand is used as a template to make this new strand. So that's DNA replication. And it's called, why is it called semi-conservative? Because a chromosome, which is double-stranded, has one strand that's completely old and one strand that is completely new. That's what we mean by semi-conservative. And the template, or this original strand right here, never breaks. If it were to break, then, okay, that would be the death of the cell in most cases. And these nucleotides right here can't rearrange themselves, because then that would call for a different kind of protein. Okay, cell cycle. So the cell goes through a life cycle. I think we're pretty much almost done with this. Okay, the cell cycle has two main phases to it. There is a phase when it is splitting, right, when it's undergoing reproduction, when it's splitting into two daughter cells. And then there's another phase where it is just doing the job that it's supposed to be doing. If it's an endocrine gland, it's producing a hormone and secreting it. Okay. If it's a muscle cell, then it's contracting. So depending on what the cell is, whatever it's designed to do, then that cell is in what we call interphase. And then when it's time for that cell to divide by mitosis, right, that is the second phase. Mitosis is a second part of the life cycle, and we kind of see it on this diagram here. So here is one part of the cell cycle. This is what we call interphase. The cell is not dividing. It's just maybe getting ready to divide, or it's producing proteins that this particular cell should be doing, or it's doing its function that it should be doing, like contraction if it's a muscle. Okay, when it's time to divide into two daughter cells, then we call that mitosis. So here is mitosis. And it's got some phases. You're familiar with these phases. First one is prophase, then metaphase, anaphase, telophase. And you have to know each of these phases and, of course, the correct order and maybe some things that are going on in these different phases. And I want to show you how to change this diagram just a little bit. So when you look at the nucleus in interphase, all of this chromatin, which makes DNA, is being used. So what form does DNA, or what form does chromatin take when it's being used? Is it extended or condensed? It's extended. And since you have miles and miles and miles of DNA that's all extended, if you look at the nucleus, you don't see any chromosomes. It looks like if there's a homogeneous color to the nucleus. You don't see any structure inside the nucleus because the DNA is being used. When it's time for the cell to divide by mitosis, all that extended chromatin has to be put into a chromosome. Then what kind of chromatin does it become? Condensed chromatin, when it's wound up on all those histones, right? And it's packaged into a chromosome. And now, during this first phase of mitosis, I can actually see some chromosomes underneath the light microscope. I can see some chromosomes right here. Right, so you know prophase because you can begin to see formation of chromosomes or the condensation of extended chromatin into condensed chromatin. That's the same thing as saying as making a chromosome that you can see underneath the microscope. They attach themselves to these microtubules And one of the jobs of a microtubule is to move things around inside the cell. Right, so it attaches to these microtubules. What controls these microtubules? It is the centrosome, which is made up of centrioles, determine where these microtubules go. And then they push and pull on all of these chromosomes so that they line up right in the very equator or center of the cell. That's what we call metaphase. That's really easy to see underneath the microscope, this pattern right here. And then the replicated chromosomes separate. And that's what happens during anaphase. So the replicated chromosome looks like an X. Do we have an X anywhere? There. Okay, so here is one chromosome. Here is the second one that's the replicate chromosome. They're joined together here at the centromere. And so this thing is exactly equal to this thing over here. Sometimes we call these daughter chromatids, like daughter cells. These are daughter chromatids because they're connected together. One is just an exact copy of the other. What produced this exact copy over here? What kind of replication was that? So the process is replication, but what kind of replication is this?
DNA.
Yeah, DNA to DNA is what we call replication, but what kind of replication? Is this thing all old DNA and this thing all new DNA? Do you want to say, no, over here, the strand is half new, half old. The strand over here is half new, half old. So we call that semi-conservative replication, right? Semi-conservative replication. So typically when people look at this structure, we call it a chromosome, but what should you appreciate? It is a chromosome, but it has gone through replication. There are two copies of that chromosome joined together to make it look like this X, and they're joined together at the centromere, and the centromere is the thing that is attached to the microtubules. So this is one chromosome, exactly the same as this one over here. So when we look at mitosis, during anaphase, those two sister chromatids separate, right, at that centromere, and then you have two daughter chromosomes. And that's why at the very end, or at the very beginning, you had 46 chromosomes in this cell, and at the end of mitosis, you got 46 over here and 46 over here, because part of the job of interphase is DNA replication by that semi-conservative process that we looked at. Okay, and that happens during the S phase of interphase, DNA replication. Okay, cytokinesis, we see that the cell splits apart. It does so by forming a cleavage furrow between these two cells, like a dimple, and the dimple gets deeper and deeper and deeper, and then finally these two cells split apart. And you get 46 chromosomes here, 46 chromosomes here, you get mitochondria over here, mitochondria over there, right? So these are just exact copies of the parent cell. That process of separating cytoplasm into two daughter cells is what we call cytokinesis. So separation of cytoplasm into two daughter cells is cytokinesis. The separation of this genetic material into two daughter cells is what we call mitosis. So there's a little bit of difference between cytokinesis and mitosis. So for mitosis, what's being separated? What would you like to think of? Mitosis separates genetic material, and cytokinesis separates cytoplasm, okay, into two separate daughter cells. So the processes are a little bit different. Cytokinesis only happens at the end of mitosis. Doesn't happen in prophase, metaphase, or anaphase. And for this class, I want you to just remember that cytokinesis takes place in telophase. That's not shown very nicely. Actually, it's not shown at all on this slide. But I want you to know that cytokinesis is something that happens during telophase of mitosis. And scientists will be talking about, well, sometimes it begins in anaphase, and sometimes maybe it still happens past telophase, okay? And they'll be discussing this for maybe about another 100 years or so, and you guys have to take a test before 100 years is up. So I'm just going to define cytokinesis taking place during telophase, and that's it for this class, okay? And what is cytokinesis again? The separation of? cytoplasm into two daughter cells, while mitosis is the separation of genetic material into two daughter cells. Okay, and that all happens within mitosis, which is in between interphases. Okay, so you can see interphase has three main parts. It has G1, S, G2. G1 is when organelles replicate themselves. So if you have one, then you have two. That's what we mean by replication. Usually we don't say duplication. We like to say replication. So for instance, centrioles replicate during G1. During S, DNA is replicated. G2, if anything needs to replicate, the cell checks to make sure that it has all the right pieces. All right, so the final checking for mitosis takes place during G2. Final growth happens. So if there's an organelle that needs to be replicated, it's replicated in this area of G2. And if the cell is missing something, then mitosis does not take place. That's the job of G2, just to check to make sure that everything is ready to go for mitosis. That there's two copies of everything, and all the factors that are necessary, all the proteins that are necessary for mitosis are indeed inside the cell. That's what G2 is for. Okay. All right, so we talked about this thing. Here I see extended chromatin forming into condensed chromatin. And what phase of mitosis does this take place? Extended into condensed. That is the very first phase, which is prophase. That happens during prophase because we can see chromosomes in prophase, right? That's when extended chromatin condenses. Okay, metaphase, chromosomes line up in the equator of the cell. Anaphase, the replicated chromosomes split apart. And telophase is the last phase. The daughter chromosomes get pulled to opposite ends of the cell. And the cell, what else happens during telophase? Somebody was really close to saying, I heard, yes, cytokinesis happens during telophase. All right, there's some other things that you should read about in your book. Like during prophase, the nuclear membrane disappears. During telophase, the nuclear membrane starts to reappear. So there are some other things that happen. Oh, here's a list of things. And I think I've talked about all these already. Here are some pictures. Are these exam figures? I don't know if these are exam figures. Probably in anatomy they were, but I don't think they're exam figures for this class. But could you tell the difference between this area here in this cell and this area right here? What's the difference between these two cells? I see like a ring right here. What's that ring? That's the nuclear membrane. Do you see that nuclear membrane here?
No.
All right, so that's one of the characteristics of prophase. The nuclear envelope, nuclear membrane disappears. And here I see just pretty much a homogeneous color. Do you see chromosomes in this nucleus? I see maybe little differences in color, but I don't see anything that looks like a worm. I don't see chromosomes. What about here? Do you see any like structures forming right here? Yes, that's another characteristic of prophase, condensation of chromatin. All right, so this is a good example of a cell in prophase. Ah, look at all these chromosomes lined up right in the middle of the cell. That is, it's got to be metaphase. All right, and now I can see that the daughter chromatids that we have right here have separated into daughter chromosomes. So when do the daughter chromosomes start to separate? During anaphase. Right, and then the very last phase, okay, this cleavage furrow forms, separates the cytoplasm into two daughter cells, and what I don't see right here, but will happen, the nuclear envelope will reappear. Those are all characteristics of telophase. All right, so that's the end phase of mitosis, which now you can probably tell me what telo means, because it means the end of something. Right? So sometimes if we want to look at the tip or the end of a chromosome, we can call that the telomere because that's the end. So that's a very important part of the chromosome, that tip right there. So every cell has a certain amount of DNA at that tip, and every time that cell undergoes mitosis, that DNA polymerase, well, remember RNA polymerase makes RNA, DNA polymerase makes DNA, that DNA polymerase can't replicate the end of a chromosome. So the very end is lost every time the cell undergoes mitosis. And then sooner or later, there is not enough chromosome for mitosis to take place, and that cell dies. Right? We call that senescence. Senescence, when that cell gets too old, the cell dies. And that's a very important kind of process in our bodies. Right? Because we don't want to just grow cells our whole life, because we wouldn't want mitosis taking place all over in our body, because what would happen to us if that happened our whole life? We get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and then we'd be like Colossus man and woman, right? We'd be so big we couldn't even fit into a building. So as cells undergo mitosis, certain cells in our body have to die. And so we call that, sometimes we call that apoptosis, right? Or senescence when that happens. That's a very important kind of process. Let's just say one cell in your body has an enzyme to replace those ends that DNA polymerase can't make. So what happens to that cell that never loses this telomere? It undergoes mitosis, never loses a telomere. What can happen? It undergoes mitosis again, never loses a telomere. Then those cells undergo mitosis again, and that happens again and again and again. And yeah, so that cell, right, just replicates itself over and over and over again. And so that's the genesis, that's the building of a tumor inside somebody's body, right? If those cells never die, they just accumulate and form a tumor. Usually they're not functional compared to the original cell. And if any of those tumor cells break away from the tumor and go to another location in the body and start to grow and form another tumor, what do we call that process? Got a couple names. Specifically, it's called metastasis, but it's a hallmark of cancer. Okay, so one way that cancer cells develop is because they never lose this telomere right here. Right? And if we could figure out a way how to stop that process, then of course you could cure cancer. That would be really nice, and a lot of people are looking at that. Okay, the role of a centrosome. Here's a centrosome. Centrosome is made up of these two centrioles. They're like barrel-shaped structures. They're made up of microtubules. They line up perpendicular to each other, and they arrange and control the microtubule and microfilament structure inside the cell. And remember, those are just monorails inside the cell that allow chromosomes and organelles to move around, like a vesicle to move from Golgi to the cell membrane. It's controlled by these things here, the centrosome. And we saw how important they were for mitosis. Telomere. Oh, just talked about the telomeres. And the enzyme that tumor cells have is called telomerase, right? How do you know that's an enzyme? Because of the ASE over here. So this telomerase rebuilds the telomere of a replicated chromosome so that they're exactly the same, so that cell line never dies as a result. It forms a tumor. Mitosis. Maybe we'll talk about this. You don't have slides for mitosis. When we get to the reproductive chapter, we'll talk about mitosis. And so that's it for the test coming up. So who's got any questions? Oh, there's one thing I did forget. Don't forget, sign-in sheet is going around. One thing I did forget is, I just forgot it again. One thing I did forget had something to do with mitosis, I think. Oh, no. Okay, so this cell is, what did we call this? What's the name for this chapter that we're looking at? Cell structure, right? Cell structure is part of it. Okay, so I would like to ask you, now, I did mention this, what is the structural and functional unit of life? What's the building block of life? A cell. Yeah, did I mention that enough so that it's jumps right into your mind when somebody asks that? So if something is alive, it's got to be made up of cells. And if it's not made up of cells, then it's not a living process, not a living structure. Okay, that's all I wanted to say. Structural and functional unit, I'll mention that concept a lot. And I think maybe this is the first time I've mentioned that. Oh no, structural. What's the structural and functional unit of communication between cells? What did we call that? A synapse, that's right. So if you can think of that unit in your mind, then you know a lot about how all synapses work. If you know how a cell is put together and how it works, you know how all life basically works, right, at that level. So that structural and functional unit is a really powerful way to think about certain kinds of things, like life. And contraction and communication and all that kind of stuff. All right, I'm turning on some lights. That's my goal. Don't forget to sign the sign-in sheet. Next time, are you going to forget your picture ID? You are not. I'm glad.